Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebel. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hey guys, we're back again. This week with me, I have Lexi Mills, and what she does is integrate PR and SEO, basically by helping agencies work with businesses, right? That's what you're doing.
Yeah, that's correct. We have some individual clients as well, but largely we help agencies build PR SEO departments, get their teams working together, and help get their clients' teams working together. Because increasingly, these teams that were on separate budgets, on separate floors, sometimes in separate buildings, are now having to work side by side. And there are tensions because we all have different objectives, different KPIs, and trying to align those can be quite challenging. But we've been doing it for a while, so we're pretty experienced at what road bumps you can hit and what methods actually help this. Biggest one being put your teams on the same floor really helps.
That's funny. Yeah, right before the call started, we just talked about the music industry a little bit. And yeah, I just found out Lexi used to work in the music industry too. And launch was like 60 albums, you said, per month, per year?
Oh, yeah, sometimes per week when it was a global firm. But I actually began my career also in music, and that's how I learned all about PR and SEO. It was bizarrely when Facebook was just starting to get big, and I didn't even know it was called SEO. But I knew it was working. And so before I knew the words, I was sort of doing it. And the music industry is a great place to start that because you have a lot of freedom in a way that you don't have if you're working with a big pharmaceutical company or maybe an airline. So it was quite nice to start out SEO without restrictions and then learn how to do great, exciting things with restrictions later on.
Can you talk about that a little bit? What do you mean by without restrictions and with restrictions? Maybe some listeners can't understand that.
Of course. So in the music industry, if I want to do a PR stunt around Michael Bolton's hair, I'm probably more likely to get Michael to sign off on that. Whereas if you want to do a big, crazy content idea that's going to get loads of media attention for a huge corporate brand that has a huge brand management team, there's a lot more people that have to buy into that idea and a lot more things you have to coordinate with as well. And so being able to start off coming up with lots of crazy ideas and talk maybe just one or two people into it who are more used to doing unusual things, because that's the nature of the music industry, and creative things as well, and the ability to visualize ideas, and then moving on later on to say, okay, so how do I get someone that's never thought about an online PR stunt to get what I'm talking about, to see and feel how it would work and understand how this will resonate with their audience without stepping on any toes of other departments.
Do you work with any smaller businesses?
Yeah, we work with quite a few. I adore smaller businesses for very much the same reason. If I'm working with a huge brand and we come up with an idea, it could be anything from 1 to 3 months to get sign off through all the different channels and all the departments and refining the idea. And sometimes it destroys the idea, the refinement process, and you spent 2 months on it. Whereas with us and our small clients, we go straight in, we can get pretty much everyone who's a stakeholder at a table, brainstorm ideas together, get a feel for what people are excited about, what they're not, and what news we could go out with and get sign off pretty much there and then. And that means that the creative process moves so much faster. And it really is the advantage of a smaller business is their agility, especially when it comes to creative content, design, creation, and promotion.
I seen on your website that you walk some of the teams through some case studies and real life examples. Can you give us maybe one or two so that people understand this integration of SEO and PR, how that would work for a smaller business?
Sure. So sometimes it can be really simple. I'm a big believer whenever we start with a client, we look for the smoothest, easiest route and then scale up the way we work. So you don't go in and say, we want to do this crazy campaign and integrate across every channel from the word go. You say to them, oh, you have a new hire. Why don't we write a post for your blog about it, and we'll promote the new hire and why you've hired them and what the business is doing to some small business publications. And that allows them to get an idea of what the process looks like when you're doing PR SEO. So you've got what I call anchor content, something on the website that the media can reference, which would be the blog post. And then you pick an audience, slightly restructure that, and give them the opportunity to maybe interview someone, some extra information that's not in the post, and you promote that and get it placed with links back to the blog post, because the blog post will give the readers of the article and the publication a bit more background. And then you can say to a client, okay, now let's scale that. Let's do a great piece of research. Put that on your website and we'll do a similar process. And after that, you say, hey, you know that research we did? Why don't we ask your email list or your customer base or your social media audience a couple of questions to give some more context to that research? And it's that way you then write another post, put it up with the research, and you promote out the new findings. And that way you're sort of easing a client into the process of integration, because it can be very complicated to work out the small little road bumps you're going to hit along the way with the integration. You know, for example, maybe there are 3-4 campaigns scheduled for the next 3 months, which tells you that you need your PR and SEO planning to be 3 months ahead in order to coordinate with social. And it's much better to find those things out in pieces rather than find them all out in one go and have to rethink everything. It also keeps momentum up, because momentum and motivation are very closely linked. And if people aren't motivated, they're not excited. And if they're not excited, you don't get the coverage.
So what you mean by PR and SEO is getting a piece of content out there, bringing some other people in, hopefully to add to that content, and then hoping they're going to backlink. And that's the SEO part.
We don't hope they're going to backlink. Designing content that deserves to be linked to, mm-hmm. that actually does a journalist a favor because they can reference a source, it enhances the quality of their article, that's very core to what we do. And that can take quite a bit of time, but we look all the time at what journalists are linking to understand what they consider worthy of a link, and we ask them. So we have a journalist consulting board, and we go to them with all sorts of questions all the time. They review all our content, all our ideas, all our media materials. But we also ask them questions like, what do you link to? Why do you link to things? What content can someone put on their website that will help you substantiate your story? So we're looking for a win-win when it comes to getting links from journalists. We want them to feel like they won because of the content they're linking to. And of course, we win from an SEO perspective. And that's an evolving process. And there are many ways to do it, you know, from small pieces like the little bits of business news that we were talking about now, to creating huge campaigns where, you know, there are several different reasons a journalist might link to it. And maybe even several places on your website they might want to reference. But there are some stories and some tactics that just definitely lend themselves far more to generating inbound links than others. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't do the others. By all means, there are, you know, there's great brand benefits to being mentioned in big publications that don't reference you with a link. And we still do that as well. But a lot of our clients come to us because they want to build their brand. They want to get influential coverage that drives conversions, but they also want coverage that builds links to help them optimize their site. So we tend to focus a lot more on campaigns that do everything in one go.
What's an example of one of these campaigns? Because as a small business owner, we have limited budgets, right? So the content that gets put out, I mean, hopefully it's something the journalists link to, which I'm still not sure what that is, you know, what they told you. But what would you recommend? Like, what's a good example of that? So how do you get the attention of the media once you get an article out that you think they want to link to?
Well, a lot of the work is done before the article's even live. So when we come up with a bunch of ideas, we evaluate them for what is quick, what is easy, what is impactful. And then we take the short list of ideas through to our journalist consulting board. So that will be, we'll pick a selection of journalists from the board to say, what are your views on these ideas? And they will give us their feedback on how we can make them better, which ones they don't think media will like. And then we get down to our final idea. We then go about building out the content, and throughout the whole process, we're getting real media feedback on what is it they're interested in, what part is strongest, what needs tweaking, adjusting, and the same with the media materials. We then tend to sell in the story before it goes live. So we call this embargo. So you tell a journalist, we've got a story going live on the 15th of July. I can send you the details under embargo now. And that means that they have time to write the story up, because this is a big problem for journalists. They're very, very busy. And if a huge news story breaks, they have no choice but to turn their attention to that. And by the time they get back to their normal workflow, your email is so far down the bottom of their inbox, they're never going to find it again. So it's really important to give them enough time to write a story so you can chase them up and say, hey, we spoke about this, you were interested. Do you need anything else to help you with the story? Do you need images, interviews? And we tend to follow up with journalists a minimum of 3 times. And we find that gets the best results. And selling it in under embargo means that we often get a bunch of coverage that goes live the day we lift the embargo. And that means you get almost like a domino effect. If 4 or 5 people cover something, probably 7 or 8 will, because a lot of journalists will look at other publications to see what articles are being tweeted a lot, talked about a lot, have just gone live, and then they'll seek to cover them too. So by giving yourself a head start and lining up coverage in advance, you really give yourself a massive, massive advantage. So with clients, we try to take them through an evolution process. So in America, for example, media tend to like to cover bigger brands than smaller brands. Whereas in Britain, there is a preference for the big brand news, but smaller companies certainly get, at least from my experience, more of a fighting chance in the media. So sometimes we'll say to a client, right, we need to get you known more. So when we ring a journalist, they know who you are. So that might mean that we do a local campaign to get you some coverage locally. Then we might do some trade campaigns in your trade media, because a lot of national journalists will look at trade media as a way of understanding what the emerging trends are and use that to fuel stories for national news. So once you've gotten local, it's easier to get in trade. Once you've gotten trade, it's easier to get in national. And as you start to build up your brand and your awareness of your brand and also your intellectual authority, what you have to offer journalists in terms of quotes, interviews, insight, that massively helps when you launch a campaign that's targeted more towards national media. And you don't just try go for one journalist. We usually isolate the publications that we think will be most interested, and then we find the best journalist there. But journalists go on maternity leave, vacations, they could be out the office on a special assignment. So it's always important to have a couple of journalists that you know you can go to. And on the day of launch, you know, we wouldn't have always locked down every publication that we want at all. You know, some journalists will say, I'll see how other people cover it, and if lots do, I'll cover it. You know, so on the day of launch, we will ring through to all the news desks of all the major publications that we think will be interested. And when you ring a news desk, you don't know who's answering the phone, because they're manned by different people at different times every day. So you ring, you tell them the story, and they'll either direct it to someone on the appropriate news desk, or they'll write it up themselves. And it's hard work, not going to lie about that. Ringing through to news desks, they're busy. They're not always the warmest of journalists because they're so busy. And you just have to, I always say to my team, be a duck. Just let it wash off you and keep going. And you have to keep going. You know, there's this big belief that, you know, stellar campaigns just fly out the door and build links and get loads of coverage straight away. I've had a lot of really successful campaigns in my life, and all of them really took a kicking to get out the park. And you know, sometimes that meant a week or two of really pushing something until you get that one piece of coverage that just sort of sets off a snowball effect. But the important thing is to keep pushing, keep your spirits up, keep your team spirits up, and understand that really very few campaigns fly on day one off the shelf. And that's fine. And you just got to keep asking journalists, okay, what is it about the story? Do I need to adjust my wording of my pitch? Maybe I need to slightly adjust my audience. If you've got a story that sits between tech and business, you might have thought and had the feedback that business were going to cover it. But if you're not getting the traction there, you need to step back and not throw it in the bin, but say, okay, what's the next stage? Maybe we need to rewrite the pitch to target tech more. And I've had to do this many times. And I always think that when we launch a campaign, it's actually in its final stage of evolution. You don't launch it when it's perfect. You launch it thinking this could be perfect, but you have to accept that it might need a lot of tweaks. Sometimes it can come down to something really, really simple. Like a particular word you've used. I launched an IoT, Internet of Things handbag, that was designed to stop impulse shopping. So it would lock shut when you were in your peak spending zones and peak spending times. And it did all kinds of fun things. And it was very much a PR stunt. But we were promoting it as an IoT handbag. But it turned out, even though the search volume for robotics wasn't super high, that what actually made media really excited was a robotic handbag. Such a small change in wording. And that campaign, we got about 7 pieces, I think, on day one, but we ended up getting over 70 over the course of 6 months for that campaign, because we kept pushing, kept tweaking it, kept adjusting it to the market. You know, if any celebrity got caught, you know, with their credit card bouncing somewhere, we were out there pushing it, saying, we need to give them this handbag. You know, so you've got to continuously look for those opportunities to get a campaign out. I think as search marketeers, we're very susceptible to launching something. If it doesn't work straight away, throwing it in the bin and focusing on the next thing. But I'm a big believer in treat campaigns like oranges. You've got to squeeze all the juice out of them. And usually there's a good 6 months to a year's worth of juice in every campaign. And the best campaigns are repeatable. So they're stories that you can go out with year in, year out, with just updated figures or insights. And that means that it's kind of like a never-ending glass of orange juice when it comes to PR and SEO value.
What's an example of one of those? That's super interesting. A story that you can update and go in year in and year out.
Sure. So there's several types. I suppose a good one is I was, again, working for a price comparison site. I was walking around New York City because I'd only been there a year and a half. I'd been living in Britain before. And I was like, wow, Americans are wild about Halloween. I mean, there are so many pumpkins. And I was like, this is great. I'm so happy to be here. But then I was like, there are actually a stupid amount of pumpkins. So I called the team and said, hey, how much do you think Americans spend on pumpkins in a year? And they went off and found out. And we promoted that figure, and I think it's like 1.4 billion. It's huge. It's wow. Like absolutely incredible. And we promoted that story out, and we created a page format for putting that story out on the website. So we had that anchor content I was talking about. We built a press list. We made a press release, and we had a pitch email, and we were calling and emailing it out. And then a few weeks later, it was Thanksgiving. And I was like, they're pretty wild about turkeys too. And so we did the same thing. We used the same method, research methods, to work out how much is spent on Thanksgiving. And we also provided advice on how to cut your spending on Thanksgiving, because it was a, you know, price comparison site. But so it was on brand. But we used the same page format, the same formulas, almost the same press release, just with, you know, the tweaks to update it to Thanksgiving. And then we went out to the same journalists, because we already knew they liked to cover these kind of big figured what Americans are spending type stories. And the great thing is that we already knew who would cover it, but it also gave us a chance to build that list a bit further, which meant when it got to Christmas, we went out and we looked at the cost of unwanted Christmas presents. Same formula, same page content. But now we've got 2 campaigns worth of journalists that now know us, and they know how we format things. We also know that they link. We know how when they're in the office, know some of their kids' names. And so promoting that campaign was even easier. And so now we do that for, you know, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Valentine's. And some of them get different results in terms of volume. You know, some of them will get 5 pieces of coverage. Some will get 50, depending on the news cycle and what else is going on. But it's such low effort for us to produce those figures now and get the pages up on the site and write the press materials and promote it that actually it doesn't matter if we're getting 5 pieces of coverage. It's still a good ROI with regards to our time. And every year we can do the same thing, and every year it gets a little easier and a little better results. So when you can find things that you can do sort of repeatedly year on year, the effort goes down and the results go up. I mean, that's the dream, right? In any campaign. Same with the report we did for Syndicate Room. It was, they'd run a similar piece of research the year before. So we were updating the research and just improving upon it based on what we'd seen the media had covered, what we knew was trending now. And next year, I'd be very surprised if they don't do it again. And now they've got an even bigger list of people to go out with the news to. So anything that you can repeat, you know, monthly, yearly, or even bi-yearly is super, super helpful, especially for a growing team, because it means that your senior person can put the campaign together the first time round, work with the junior team to show them how they're doing it, and the next time someone more junior can put it together. And so it allows your team to grow and free up your senior staff to start on another project that maybe needs a little bit more experience in order to develop and execute. But if you can start to feed these campaigns down, you really grow a team's knowledge and their opportunity to succeed. Because so much of PR and content promotion is about confidence. And if you can hand them something that you know is going to work, you're going to really build that confidence. And there's such a high that comes when you get coverage. It's, I always think it's a bit like what I imagine gambling must be like. You're like, oh my goodness, it's here. And you think it would wear off. But I've been in the industry over 10 years and I still do a happy dance when coverage comes through.
Do you have a video of that?
Do you know what I'm sure my team do? I make them do it with me, though. So I'm dragging them down with me if the happy dance gets shown. But yes, there's definitely a happy dance, and I'm sure many people have videos of the happy dance.
That's hilarious. Can you touch on press releases a little bit? You know, I've seen people misuse them really, really bad in SEO. I'm probably not the best person at PR, so press releases are not my strong point. How should we structure it? What should we put in there? Because I assume that's the email that we send out saying, look, there's going to be an article coming out on this topic. But how do you structure that? What will you put in?
So the key question to ask yourself is, why are you sending a press release? What is its purpose? And really, a press release is just a way of summarizing all the key information that might be of interest to a journalist when they're writing an article. And it doesn't have to be a press release. In fact, when we work with big brands, we don't call them press releases. We call them media alerts, because press releases have standard sign-off procedures that, you know, children can be conceived and born in the time that some big companies can sign off a press release. But a media alert can generally be signed off fairly quickly. And all it is a way of giving someone the key information. And yes, they can work for you. A press release can be very helpful if you're sending, especially facts and figures, it looks a little bit more professional if you're sending those through to a news desk. But a lot of our promotion doesn't involve a press release at all. It's just an email, very well targeted to a specific journalist or publication that has all the key information in it. So, hi, Mr. John, I've seen you've written about this. We've actually created this piece of research that unveils this, 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 and this. We thought it would be of interest to you, and this is key, and their readers, because it's about what their readers will want, not what they personally want. They will cover things that they're not interested in if they think their readers will be. So you tell them why their readers would be interested, and you say, I have images, I have interviews, quotes, facts, figures. You want to give them everything they could ever need in a story and tell them that you've got it for them. So you're basically trying to give them a story in a box. And when we go through our PR emails, we're looking at almost a checklist. Do you have images? Do you have someone who can be interviewed? Do you have quotes? Do you have a stat? And do you have a third voice, either a customer or someone from the public that isn't from your brand? Because that is really what makes the core of any story. And if you have all of that and you're sending a journalist all those different bits, you're significantly enhancing your chance that they're going to write that story up, because you're making it quick, you're making it easy, and you're making it efficient. And if you're citing all the sources for your information, that helps too. I mean, sometimes we get given pieces of content by agencies or in-house teams, and it might be missing someone to interview or a statistic. And so we think, oh, this isn't going to make it super easy for a journalist. So we'll go off and find that stat somewhere else on the internet, and we'll try and get the client to put it on their site. But if they won't, we still give it to the journalist. And that's a really important factor to consider. You have to give them everything, even if you personally as a business haven't built everything into your campaign. If you do that, you don't need a press release. You can just have an email and it'll be fine. But it's about making it easy for them to have everything they need and understand why they would want to write about that.
That's some great advice. How important do you think media pages are on a company website?
They're quite good for a multitude of reasons. So one, if you think about SEO and the consistency of brand language, you want people online, if they're going to write about you, to know exactly how to describe your business. Now, most journalists will search the business name and probably copy across the meta tag. The amount of businesses I know that have terrible meta tags for their homepage, because it's just not something we focus on as much. You know, once the site's up and running, we're focusing on deep category pages or, you know, deep links to product pages. And sometimes we forget to update those. And then suddenly all these articles go out describing your business that in a way that's not accurate. If you have a media page on a website, on your website that says, this is who we are, this is the short description of us, the long description, this is our team. Here are downloadable photos at 72 dpi and 300 dpi of all our key spokespeople. And here are our logos. You can be pretty sure that you're going to get more pickups of your images. Your company is going to be described more accurately. And if you're doing local SEO, you know, it's important to have the consistency of where the company is located written very clearly and consistently across, you know, any promotion that you're doing, so it can help there. And it saves your PR team or whoever's managing PR time. For me to be sending out photos and things like that is not the best use of my time. If I can, you want me on the phone talking to journalists, building out great campaigns, not sending them things that they could actually get themselves.
What potential do you think machine learning and AI have within internet search? Because I've seen it on your website. I'm curious.
Oh, I'm very excited about machine learning and AI. I mean, I'm looking at it both from the marketeer's perspective, but I'm also looking at the applications of machine learning and AI outside the field of search. So I'll talk about them sequentially. So at the moment, we're finding that customized search is getting better and better, which means our customers are essentially getting stuck in more filter bubbles. This means that they build this sort of cocoon of websites that they look at, people they follow, and these become bubbles that they almost can't see out of. Now, if we look at what happens if you only exist in a bubble, it will give you a good idea of what this means for marketeers. So Microsoft had a chatbot called Tay that was launched on the internet a couple of years ago now. Tay started off super friendly and happy. Within 24 hours, Tay had been learning from Twitter users, and Tay became racist, xenophobic, offensive, and Microsoft had to shut Tay down. But Tay was actually just a reflection of her data set or the bubble of data she was existing in. And we need to be aware of that, because if we're trying to influence people, we need to know the bubbles that they're locked into and try and get into them. A really good example of this is when you're trying to do financial advice. So I do a lot of work with price comparison sites, and they often want to get links and coverage from finance pages. And that's all well and good. That builds the brand, builds trust. But you know who really doesn't need financial advice? People who are looking for it. People who need financial advice are looking at really expensive handbags. And that's why when we made the robotic handbag, we got a fashion designer to design it, because it needed to fit in fashion pages, because the people who really needed our help never enter the financial advice bubble. But if we could burst into it, onto a bubble that they're already in, we had stood a chance of pulling them out and giving them the help and information they need. And this is really important, because this isn't going to happen at an accelerated rate with the introduction of machine learning and AI. So we need to start being able to simulate that. And I'd be surprised if there aren't technologies being developed by a multitude of agencies already that are trying to work out how do we simulate the bubbles of our audiences. As PRs, we somewhat do that, and we know it is second nature from our previous experience. But with the introduction of all these new digital platforms, that's changing constantly. So we really need to stand back and model that, which is why I always make an effort to be a customer. If I'm working for a client, I will use their product. Nobody goes into a meeting for one of our clients unless they've been in one of their hotels, one of their venues, used the price comparison site, bought something from their website and gone through that whole experience. And ideally, you also want to meet other people who have done that. It'll give you a lot more insight into what content you need to create and how these people communicate. You know, are they visually led? Are they data led? What helps them change their mind and move from thinking about something to action?
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And with publishing, we have AI too, which is something we need to hack. You know, 12% of some of the business coverage coming out of Reuters and the Associated Press, which fuels most of the national media across America, is auto-generated by artificial intelligence. So we're not just pitching humans with these beautiful customized emails. We have to pitch artificial intelligence too, which means we need to be structuring how we communicate to fit both the AI systems and the human reality, which is that they're busy, which is why you send one email and you think you're getting through, you may as well have not bothered sending the first. You've got to send at least two and ideally get on the phone as well. So being aware of how machine learning is influencing publishers, consumers, but also our own personal world, you know, data overload, what actually catches our attention? One of the things I do when I start a training session with a team or an agency, so I just go around the table and I'll say to people, tell me, what was the first thing you did when you woke up? And it always makes me laugh, because all the parents, it's not their baby that they check in the morning. It's their Facebook, it's their Twitter, it's their digital comms. And that's really important to recognize. Baby's close second most of the time. But the way we engage, we don't wake up and look at our trade publications. We wake up and look at our personal connections. We wake up and look at Instagram if we're visually led, or YouTube. And that's really important, because that tells you, okay, if I'm doing this, I'm probably not utterly unique. And it's true. You know, no parent should feel guilty about checking their mobile phone before their child. It's I've never met an honest parent that doesn't. You know, if people say they don't, I don't really believe them. And I've never had anyone say it to me anyway. So it's important to keep an eye on how we're changing. You know, we didn't need big research reports to tell us that mobile technology was going to change the way marketeers had to work. We were all using our mobiles 24/7. If the penny didn't drop through our own interactions and observing people around us, you know, then okay, fine, maybe you do need a research paper. But the observation of other people is more important than anything else. So hang out at airports and just be creepy and watch people. I go for coffee a lot on my own. Not coffee anymore, because I stopped drinking. I have tea now. And I just watch. A couple of weeks ago, I sat down, had a coffee. Well, was it tea, coffee? I stopped drinking in October, so it was probably tea. And there were three pensioners sat next to me. And I was thinking about leaving, and I thought, no, I don't know much about pensioners. What if I get a product that I need to promote that's targeted at pensioners? And actually, coincidentally, I did a month later. So I sat and asked them, how do you feel about technology? Does it make you feel helpful about the world? Are you excited for the future and what it can bring? Do you think it's harming us? Do you think it's making us better people? Are you interested in engaging with it? These guys were super happy to chat to someone, and they had some incredible opinions. I thought they'd be really adverse to it, but actually they were super excited. And if I hadn't asked those questions, when this client rang asking for PR support for a product aimed at old age people, I wouldn't have had the information to understand that market. So it's really important to talk to strangers.
Lexi, I really appreciate you coming on. Where can people find you?
You can come to me through my website, lexiemills.net, or you can email me at lexi@shift6.org.
And Shift 6, that's the company?
It is. Our website's being rebuilt, should launch in about 2 weeks, but probably 3 knowing timelines for website build and launch.
Very good. Okay. Thank you so much.
It's an absolute pleasure. Have a beautiful day. Nice to speak to you.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect Liebelt. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.